The world's first general interest magazine was published here in London by Edward Cave way back in 1731. For the price of sixpence, the Gentleman's Magazine promised a view of the weekly essays and controversies, some poetry, foreign affairs, and advice on gardening too. Sounds a little bit familiar almost. Needless to say, today's market for general interest publishing has dramatically shifted. We'll assess the state of the newsstand today on The Stack. On today's show, grab your sunglasses and perhaps pour yourself another Aperol Spritz. We're casting our eye over what makes the modern gentleman's title.
But when you look in these issues of Popeye, when you flick through these pages, incredible.
Also ahead, what does a voracious reader do when their favourite book review section vanishes from the broadsheets? Well, they start their own critical journal, of course.
The print started for two reasons. One is that we had a number of people who are completely still in love with print. And there are good reasons to be in love with print.
That's all to come on The Stack. 30 minutes of print industry analysis right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Today, we'll get right to it. I am joined by two residents of this building. One gentleman, we've got a bit of a history. We've been working together, looking at covers and many things in between for a very long time. Our very own creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, is here. And just upstairs, not quite above Richard, but a little bit across, other side of the building, we also have Adam Thompson here, senior strategist at our sister company, Wink Creative. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I should probably set up and say that we all venture down to the studio. We're going to talk about gentlemen's magazines, but specifically we're talking about Popeye, a title which is just celebrating its 40th anniversary out of Japan, and it is brought to its readers and us by Magazine House. You look through the ads. Now, the copy that I'm looking at from you right now, the date on it is
18?
Yeah, I think it is 1980, this one.
Yeah.
And, Rich, exactly you said, like, I flip it to the outside back cover, and on a muggy day like today in London, they've got this just fantastic bit of packaging, tonic and fresh shampoo, which is just just what you want to dump on your head when you get home. But then as you go through this, you can see this moment of the popularity of the 35mm camera, the amount of advertising for stereos, the arrival of the Ghetto Blaster. But I love this Techniques ad of this really small mini cassette player. I think this is something which must have just stayed in Japan. I've never seen anything like it. And then, it's, you can see that the money in that, in that moment, maybe where today you see a lot more fashion advertising.
Yeah.
Actually, what's interesting for a title like this, it's not dominated by luxury advertising at all. I mean, the opening spread, I'm surprised you don't have a pair of, maybe you do have a pair of these under the desk, Rich. These UCLA trainers. It's a trainer. I've never heard of this trainer before. With this just lovely logo on the side. We've obviously got many copies here. If you open the current, well, who's on the outside back cover of this one?
Louis Vuitton, I think.
Hermes.
Yeah.
Hermes.
And then there's a lot of luxury advertising. But here, then you go to the next spread. It's a Toyota ad. Also black and white ad. And it's the complete Toyota lineup of all of their crazy little microvans, mini Land Cruisers. There's no sense of any luxury industry at all. Not even a watch up front.
I mean, this is incredible. This is an advert for an energy drink.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful. And I wonder
great
whether...
piece of illustration.
Oh.
Yeah. And it reminds you of one of our cover stars who's worked for us from time to time, Rich. Sorry, go ahead. You were going to say something.
I was going to say, just going back to the advertising roster, outside back Hermes, inside back, Supreme, skate brand.
Yeah.
They're not common bedfellows, those two. But, they attract both. I mean, that's a great bit of publishing.
I just want to go back to, you can sort of see the points of inspiration. This is the 1980 July special summer issue that we're looking at. There's a little bit of a nod to Playboy in it as well. Mm. And this idea where I think the Japanese have always been very good at engineering the perfect lifestyle. And they've done this wonderful... So they've taken the inspiration of this guy on the cover, which is this I would say sort of looks like it's pencil crayon illustration on the front cover. And then they've recreated in studio with a guy then sitting in the hammock in his summer sport shorts. And just this wonderful point of view, aerial point of view, of his ideal summer setup. Yeah. Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely brilliant.
The copy line is great as well. Hang loose in good room.
That's it.
Why not?
Says it all.
And they have that very charming way of using English, I think, in Japanese editorial. They're always... You couldn't... I don't think anyone in English could write that way.
No.
But it's just... The juxtaposition of words is just fantastic. It puts a smile on your face every time.
And you know, what could put a smile on this? More than this, this guy... Hanging loose in good room, in his, they look like OP shorts from, late 70s or early 80s, but he's in this Tommy room, but he's funked it up with his drawers. He's got, an interesting, some hanging arrangement on the wall, but you've got the shoji screen. And I just like also this confrontation of probably what was a very typical small flat at that time as well.
For sure,
but has been westernized, has been varsityized, and you see all of that sort of lick of America in this at the same time.
Well, I think that's something that Japanese do extremely well. I mean, you see when you go to Tokyo, when you go to an Italian restaurant in Japan, and it's as good as you get in Italy. The Japanese are incredibly good at repackaging other people's stuff. Now, I would never pick a U.S. city as a
place
to go to.
But we say repacking and enhancing it.
And enhancing.
Yeah.
I would never pick a U.S. city to go to on a shopping trip. Okay, people might love New York. I would choose Tokyo over that. But when you look in these issues of Popeye, they repurpose all of that, varsity, Yale, Ivy League style. And they just sell it back to you in a way that you want to buy it. I would never pick up on it in the States. But when you're in Japan, when you flick through these pages, incredible. And it, again, this current issue, the new one, the 40th anniversary one, it's all about LA, California. And again, it's not my first pick of destination, but when you see the amount of stuff that they've uncovered, it just looks like the best place in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you just want to book your ticket and get out there.
Absolutely. The issue that the other issue that I bought by is from 1983, and it's entitled Somebody's Trip. And it's great. They just have this kind of like roaming, it's very illustrative, really colourful, and just kind of leads you. You kind of want to go back to these places, like 25, however many years later. Sorry, that's not 25, that's like 34. But there's something really wonderful about, this idea of, being on foot and exploring places in such depth and such detail, and they go and meet people, and it's so obviously done with so much love. That you can't help but be just like drawn into the whole thing.
Mm. I think it's also amazing because obviously there was a popularity and there were certainly people who were buying Popeye even in London in the early 1980s. But it wasn't even until the probably late 1990s, early 2000s that people started jumping on the bandwagon and say, "Oh, look, Tommy Lee Jones doing like these canned coffee ads and all the different things." But I'm still on the July issue of 1980, and there's David Bowie. Oh. Endorsing a shochu, and it, all the copies in Japanese, but looking fantastic in a satin shirt, with this wonderful beverage on the rocks.
Beautiful.
And I think the value of being able to look at something like this. The other thing too is, again, so much discussion today, particularly this being the stack. Where people talk about native advertising and the amount of native advertising, which we just call it good old advertorials. And there was a wonderful piece in this issue as well for Suntory. And it's just page after page of great Suntory summer cocktails. But it's clearly advertising, but brought to you by the Popeye team. Mm-hmm. And there to completely... tie in with the summer issue as well. Mm. Here it is. Suntory Tropical 80, Mai Tai, Frozen Gin Lime, Tropical Hurricane, Daiquiri,
so
a Chi-Chi, a Salty Dog.
I think...
Time for a break.
I was going to say, I need to get a photocopy for that.
You're listening
to
the stack on Monocle 24. We're going to go off for a Salty Dog right now. Stay with us.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had
today.
A debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, our creative director at Monocle, Richard Spencer-Powell, and also our chief strategist at our sister company, Wink Creative, our branding and design agency, Adam Thompson. Gentlemen, we were just before the break talking about advertorials and looking at something that Suntory was doing in Popeye. And as I said, we were supposed to be talking about men's mags in general, but this has become a celebration in part for the 40th anniversary of Popeye magazine, title published by Magazine House. Of Japan. We're going to come back and chat about it in a moment, but we're going to head to the West Coast very, very briefly, because when Tom Lutz watched his favorite book review supplements in papers like the Los Angeles Times start to fade away, he did what any voracious reader would do. He panicked. Then he had a better idea. He saw a gap in the market and he decided to fill it himself. Starting out as a small informal journal catering to a city not well known for its literary scene, the Los Angeles Review of Books has become one of the best known titles of its kind anywhere in the world. And with a bit of help from Hollywood's elite and assorted members of LA's booming cultural scene, the magazine's future is looking rather bright. Our Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to its editor, Tom Lutz, a bit earlier.
Ton, I was just reading the story, How Did You Started Your Publication? And you said that perhaps one of the reasons for that was because, you know, the traditional newspaper supplements, you know, they've been cancelled, you know, for several reasons. And there was kind of a lack of space in the market, right?
Yeah. What used to support book talk in America was the advertising that happened in Sunday supplements and in the advertising that happened in newspapers in general. I think the Sunday supplements never quite paid for themselves, but it was considered part of what a newspaper was supposed to do. And therefore they used advertising from other parts of the newspaper. That advertising in print papers died out with the digital revolution, and one of the first casualties was the book supplement.
And it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned you know the problems with print as well, but I believe you started kind of online. But then you also have your quarterly publication, which I believe you send to some subscribers, and you have a few places where you can buy as well. How was this process of starting online and then going to have a publication and also a multimedia platform, that which is what you have now?
Well, there were two different things. We do have a multimedia platform. We have a radio show now as well, podcasts we've had since we started. We've got some channels of other websites that we run as well. So we have branched out in various ways. The print started for two reasons. One is that we had a number of people who still are, and they tend to be some of our biggest donors, people who are completely still in love with print. And there are good reasons to be in love with print. And we wanted to have some way for them to read our work, some way for them to read our work in ways that they loved. And we also kept talking to advertisers about advertising on the website as one of our many revenue streams as we try to cobble together a way to make this work. And the advertiser said, well, you know, we advertise books, this is publishers in particular, we advertise books as a form of author relations. That is, the authors want to see their books being advertised, and they don't want to see their books advertised online. They want to see them advertised in print. And in fact, the majority of our advertising income comes from the print publication rather than from the online publication.
What is the print run, Tom?
It's tiny compared to the number of people that it's 1/100th of the number of people that come to the site, but it's a small but mighty group.
You did mention about some of the donors that help Los Angeles Review of Books. Los Angeles is the capital of entertainment in the world. Most of those donors, you know, are they kind of connected to Hollywood somehow? What's your relationship with this industry?
A number of our major donors are connected to the industry. In fact, The Hollywood Reporter, which is one of the two main industry newspapers in town, along with Variety, just did a story on us with a photo of a number of our key supporters, like Matthew Weiner, who created Mad Men, and Mary Sweeney, who was David Lynch's producer, and Michael Tolkien, who wrote The Player, and Seth Greenland, who was on the staff of Big Love and other TV shows. So there are a number of, Jonathan Demme has been a supporter from the beginning. There are a number of industry people that are important to us, but there are also, you know, the majority of money is not coming from the industry. It's coming from other people who help support literary culture in LA more generally.
That's what I want to ask you as well about the LA literary scene. I mean, at least here on the other side of the Atlantic, we're hearing great things about Los Angeles. I mean, how especially the art scene is on the rise, is extremely trendy now. I would say even more than New York at the moment. So do you think this is applying a little bit to the literary scene as well in the city?
Yes, that is. People are starting to recognize the literary scene around the world since, in ways in which, it's been a little bit slow to catch up with what's happening in L.A. The art scene, of course, got established much earlier. John Baldessari, for instance, said that when he was young, you still had to go to New York to launch an artistic career, and you don't have to anymore. You can launch it in Los Angeles. And our Philharmonic is considered the best in the country by a lot of people. The opera is considered as, one of the best. So the cultural scene in general in L.A. has moved over the last 50 years from being a kind of backwater to being at the center of a lot of the arts. And in literature, of course, ever since Faulkner and Fitzgerald and others were brought out to try their hand at screenwriting, it's been an important place where American authors have kind of cobbled together their living. So writers have always had a relation to L.A., and that means that we have a great, literate, smart, interesting, very, very diverse community of writers here, and part of that is because of the industry.
Finally, Tom, I just want to ask you, about your business model. I mean, in terms of, for the publication, would you say it's mainly from the donors and advertising, or do you have any plans to expand the magazine? I mean, I wonder if you can instruct us about that.
Yeah, when I was getting started, I read everything I could find about the kind of the future of publishing and how people were responding to the digital revolution in publishing. And one of the kind of seminal texts on the rise and death of the American newspaper, the authors argued that there were 10 or 12 different kind of funding models that people could look towards. And they argued about the possible success and the probable failure of each of those funding models now that the print advertising was dropping off. And for instance, the NPR, the state-supported model, the membership model, the subscription model, all of the different kind of possibilities. And it occurred to me that the only way to make things happen in this kind of interim period while we figure out how we do want to, as a culture, support intelligent conversation was to do a little bit of everything. So our funding model is to get as much advertising as we can, get as much event revenue as we can, get as much in the way of charitable donations. We're a nonprofit, a registered nonprofit. Get as much in the way of reprint income as we can, and just kind of cobble together all of the sources that are around and see if that works. And it's a struggle. It's going, we're swimming upstream against within what is in all sorts of ways a maybe not dying but a diminishing industry. And so it's a struggle to make ends meet, and we're not paying writers enough yet. And that's one of my main goals, is to stop letting this kind of the woes of the publishing world hit writers first. So it's a struggle. We keep working at it, and we think that all of your listeners should immediately get online and become members of Los Angeles Review of Books.
Tom Lutz, editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, in conversation there with our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to The Stack here, Monocle 24. It's time to go back to our discussions about all things Men's Mag related, but specifically Popeye. Rich, you've got, you just mentioned a little bit earlier that they actually reprinted the first edition. and it came bundled in with of course, what is the regular edition, that which is celebrating the 40th anniversary. You were saying a little bit earlier, we're coming up to our 10th anniversary. Getting a few ideas? Do you think that it might be worth going and reprinting that cover with our Japanese Navy chopper pilot back from 2007?
Well, why not? Why not? I mean, it's... it's very rare now. It's very expensive to get hold of one of those. Why not do a reprint? I think what's quite interesting about doing a reprint of something that's 40 years old is how did they do it, actually? Because, you know, this is we're talking about bridging the difference, you know, from analog into digital. That would have been quite a hard feat, I'm sure.
It would have been hard for you, Rich, that's for sure.
I'd have had to get about 15 assistants to help me do that. But I wonder how they've actually achieved it, because... yeah, they must have kept the film somewhere and then somehow digitized it. And that's an amazing feat that they've kept an archive and that it's lasted and that they've invested in reprinting it.
Well, if you've ever been to their offices as well, it wouldn't surprise me if there's actually someone still under one of those desks from 40 years ago. Just Robbie has everything.
Filing.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the remarkable things. If you've been to those offices, it is, I guess when you see the magazine, you think it's going to be just, you know, just the epitome of Japanese slick and chic and you know, beautifully laid out. And it is, but in a way, it doesn't let the brand down at all. This is the front lines of great magazine publishing. And there are people, it's almost like Box City under desk. I mean, people are, you can tell, they're there around the clock. I mean, I could remember, I contributed a piece about Portland, what I like about Portland, my favorite issues of Popeye in this current issue. And they were chasing me at all hours of the day because, of course, you know, I love a deadline. And I like to break a deadline. And poor Natsumi was like chasing. And she had to be in that office every hour of the day.
But you see the amount of content. It is unfathomable how they actually produce it in every month. I mean, it is so detailed and so exhaustive in terms of where they've traveled as well. Mm-hmm. It's, like you say, Tyler, it's not just... okay, let's just do our top five curry shops in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. They go everywhere.
It's thorough. I was wondering about, have you seen other instances where publishers have gone back and reprinted the first issue? I know that Playboy did it with the Marilyn Monroe first issue a year or so ago, and then Paul Smith sponsored a reprint of The Face a few years back as well.
I was going to say The Face is the one that comes to mind that got reprinted, the first issue of that. I can't think of any... any others spring
to
mind?
It's time. 10 years.
Time for a reprint.
It is. But yeah, and it's incredible that we can be, of course, hosting a program about this very topic, and it can only happen specifically in the sector of media as well. I don't think anyone is going to go back. Maybe they will in 10 years' time, but I think it'll be very complicated. And I'm looking at one of the screens in front of us in the studio. You can't say this is the day that the Daily Beast launch and all of the excitement around Tina Brown getting involved.
Absolutely.
It's gone.
Yeah, it's momentary. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the great thing, of course, about having a hard copy of something and making something collectible is that you get to see that little history kind of line up on your shelf. Well, of course, that was always our intention at the from the outset of the project.
Yeah.
And that's there will be people out there that have probably got 40 years of Popeye. And some of 10 years of Monocle.
you've marked a page, or did you mark a page? You've got an ad for a Toyota Celica 1800.
Wonderful. I want one.
Yeah.
Where can we get one? It's fantastic.
Well, and that's also, is that 80-something? 80?
This is 83.
And I like the cars were angular then.
Yeah.
And there wasn't all these organic shapes. It's proper right angles.
It's proper right angles, and it's... when you look at car advertising now, you know, we've seen it, how it, everyone uses the same angles and the same kind of shots, and it becomes so, so boring. And this is fantastic because it's got so much character. It just, yeah, it makes you want to get in and drive as fast as you can. And why not?
And just returning a little bit to native advertising, because you mentioned a very good example there in the 80s issue. In the current issue, in the 40th issue, there is a beautiful, sweet, optical eyewear advertorial where it's a little 8-page story, and on the back side of it starts off with a day in the life of a young guy, and the other side is a day in the life of a young girl, and they meet in the center spread when they go on a date, and it's such a sweet little story
and so simple
And so simple. And you kind of wonder how they
What's so interesting?
How they come up with all these concepts?
With the there's obviously things have moved on for Popeye in those 40 years. We say that it's retained a lot of the great things that it started out with. But one of the things that I was thinking about whilst looking through this issue on the Tube, which is dedicated to The Complete Walker, a very influential book about hiking, essentially. And it's so thorough, obviously. But one of the things that struck me is that all of the fashion shoots, which takes up almost half the book at the back, they actually managed to integrate things, you know, some of their advertisers, like Louis Vuitton, like Hermes, alongside, you know, the Patagonias and all this. And I just don't see any British magazines or other magazines around the world perhaps managing to achieve that balance.
Gents, just before we wrap up, I just want to pose a question, and I'll start with you. But why is it, here's a magazine which is very successful, it arrives on the desks of German automobile makers and certainly every marketing director's desk, probably, you know, everyone looking after retail of every major luxury brand around the world. So, you know, this magazine is not unknown to people in Paris and Milan and New York and elsewhere. Why do you think we haven't seen other Western titles try to do something like this? Because it's a formula that clearly works. Readers like it. It's been around for 40 years. And advertisers, you know, are falling all over themselves to be inside.
Gosh, is it to do with there is one thing about Japan, and it's you know, famed for its service and its kind of very fastidious nature, and I just wonder whether publishers elsewhere just aren't up to the challenge of something like this. And you know, it's a huge investment, and they pay their writers well, they actually invest in it, and so I think there's something around that. It's a huge, this is really laying down the gauntlet to the world as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think that could be true. I think it's an enormous amount of effort. I'm not saying that we're lazy in the West, but I think we're not so accustomed to working in this style. I also think you've got to look at what's around Popeye. I mean, this thing is made in Japan, it's made out of Tokyo. It's not, everything there is like this. You know, there's so much effort in every walk of life there that it would be wrong to do it any other way almost. And I think, unfortunately, in the West, we're a bit too formulaic. And people, I think, are just scared to break that form.
Yeah.
Which I think will be people's decline, but I think people just are too scared to take on some of the things. And I think you see that in the native advertising. You see really interesting advertorials in some Japanese magazines, and then you see the stuff in Europe, it's kind of like, that was fairly standard or expected.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is the celebrity party page with a step and repeat for a liquor brand starts to pass for an advertorial now, or native advertising, which is quite something. I think you're both right. I mean, I think we've talked about the sense of just of laziness on the editorial floor. I mean, I think you're right. I think you really have to take a deep breath and say, are we going to commit to something like this? Because once you start, you know, you're going to let the reader down on the second issue if you can't keep up that momentum. And I think that's the exciting thing. I think when all of us go to Japan, or when the brown box arrives from Yamato here in the offices, everyone wants to have a copy of this magazine first, and it continues to deliver every single issue.
Every single issue, just like me and Monocle, right?
Indeed, gentlemen, we have to leave it there. Adam Thompson from Wink Creative, our creative director Richard Spencer Powell, thanks very much for dissecting this 40th anniversary of Popeye here on the Stack. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also our editor was Toby Hammond, and ably assisted by Weidong Lin. If you want to get in touch, then do send us a note to info@monocle.com, and remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And don't forget, of course, you can also subscribe to the podcast as well. Head to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. The Stack is back next week. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a good weekend.